Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Today, the latest on health and healing. Then, no guests, so I can have an opportunity to share many different social issues, including the newest information on why we should oppose 5G. And one professor says from Washington University, it's the stupidest idea in the history of the world. I wouldn't go that far, but it is not good because it's going to be exposing probably 90% of the American population to very toxic levels of this background radiation, similar to the electromagnetic pulses that we get from our cell phones, except magnified substantially more than that. Also, something that all of us can benefit from, what every parent needs to know about children. And this is important, and I'll explain why with my own commentary when we talk about this. Then I found a young fella who was before a town council up in Maine talking about why, if a law passed, he would be unvaccinated and not allowed to attend any school whatsoever. He was very well educated, more so than I believe that the council was, and I think that you should know that this is not an exception, that children around the country from parents who are vaccine educated, they're not anti-vaxxers. They were all pro-vaccine until they did their homework. So we're going to hear from him. Also, someone who had something to say about the discrimination in our society, and I believe that he had some wise words. And why are people so unhappy? So we have a lot of these issues to deal with today. Of course, we always begin with the latest. Oh, and by the way, also, if we have a commentary today from Professor Henry Giroux of The Ghost of Fascism in the Post-Truth Era, I thought you would appreciate it as well. We begin with the latest on health and healing, and this one starts with a study in mice examines the impact of reused cooking oil. That's what you get in a lot of restaurants with their making their French fries. You have no idea what happens when the French fry oil is so hot that it literally becomes almost like varnish in our systems. There's no way the body can constructively or healthily use it. And in this case, the University of Illinois is saying that it can cause breast cancer progression. That's correct. Consuming the chemical compound found in thermally abused cooking oil, meaning they're cooking with it all day long, which is many, many restaurants, it triggers the genetic changes that promote the progression of late-stage breast cancer. That's, remember, we're talking about cooking oil that's repeatedly reheated at high temperatures. A lot of restaurants realize cooking oil is expensive. So why not just keep using it? Who's to know, right? It's back in the kitchen. But it's creating toxicological trigger mechanisms that promote tumor cell proliferation and metastasis and changes in lipid metabolism. Remember, those fries or fish, they deep fry fish and a lot of other things, they're soaking with this oil. So scientists at University of Illinois found this. They reported their findings in the Journal of Cancer Prevention Research. So stay away from any frying, deep frying, any of these oils, because we've known a long time that, in fact, I reported on this over 40 years ago, that the oil contains acrolein, and the acrolein, A-C-R-O-L-E-I-N, it's linked to very high levels of oxidative stress, which can lead to atherosclerosis and heart disease. And the oil degrades as it's heated, and polymer molecules also accumulate, raising nutritional and toxicological concerns. So if you want to know the best way of eating, eat as much raw food as possible, salads and fruits, of course. And when you do cook something, lightly cook it so that you're not scorching it and causing an alteration in the oils. And the best three oils to use that are highly resistant to higher heat would be coconut oil, macadamia oil, and mustard seed oil. From Chengshan Medical University in China, published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine, comes a study about red raspberries. They end up having metastatic properties against human nasocarcinoma cells. So when you have any form of cancer of the nose or the sinus cavities, red raspberries, that's good. And by the way, when you have the nasal cancer, it frequently metastasizes into the lymph glands in the neck, and it generally leads to a poor prognosis and makes it very difficult to treat. So red raspberries, well, something that can help treat a disease that's natural can also help prevent a disease in the first place. So use it as part of your cancer prevention program. Another natural fruit, a berry, is the black elderberry. And black elderberries have been shown in this study from Franklin Institute of Wellness to help with upper respiratory symptoms. And this was a meta-analysis, meaning they studied many different studies. This was the randomized controlled clinical trials, which is a very high standard. And so the black elderberry, and that's known also by Sambucus nigra, Sambucus nigra. It's been used for a long time to treat cold and flu symptoms. And we were looking for a large meta-analysis, and this is it. And it looked at when people took elderberry. And by the way, I believe you should take elderberry like a teaspoon of it every morning. In fact, if you took a teaspoon of elderberry concentrate and a teaspoon of Manuka honey together, you are really destroying the bacteria in your mouth, in your throat, in your gastrointestinal system, and you are stimulating natural immune modulation. So it's great. So in this analysis, they looked at all these people and found out that, yeah, it does make a difference, and it does help you, especially if you have upper respiratory symptoms, a lot of people do, and it lowers them, and it's antiviral and antibacterial. From the Weill Cornell Medical School, a high fructose corn syrup in your diet, like in sodas, promotes colon tumor growth. This was a laboratory study, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. So consuming the equivalent of just one can of soda per day, just one can, predispose these mice to colon cancer, to develop larger tumors. And that's not good. I believe that we should be not consuming any of these high carbonated, high sugar sodas. The Guangzhou University in China studied Tai Chi and found that to benefit the brains of older people. So just taking up mind-body exercises. Now, that could be ballroom dancing. It could be Tai Chi. It could be mindful meditation. Can help maintain the health of your brain and your body, especially after the age of 40. And this regime is supported by the results of a new study in which exercises that involve both mental and physical activities raise cognitive function in older adults. I remember at one time in my life, I was gifted to have several people that I had work with who were all senior citizens. I'm in my 20s, and they're in their 70s and 80s. People like Dr. Emmanuel Rivizzi and Sarah Dona, the great activist, feminist activist in the 1920s, who was a literary agent, and I volunteered to be a editor in her agency. People like Dr. Linus Pauling, the twice Nobel Prize winner. So it was not uncommon for me to be around these older people. And what I found in all of them that they had in common was they never took a day for granted. They didn't watch television. They didn't sit around and listen to radio. They were always creating. always. And in the evenings, the most interesting conversations, I mean, really deep intellects. And at the time, I had met as a young novice scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, I had met a doctor, Dr. Lawrence Lachan. And he was one of the premier psychologists in America. And he was the first to do a study and publish the results showing just by a person's temperament and background, not physical background, how completely healthy women who had no risk factors for breast cancer, he could very accurately predict which of those women would become victims of cancer simply by certain indicators, including whether they were respected and loved or appreciated or not. Later, a Dr. Gerald Kelsler, who was New York Health Commissioner of Psychiatry, who I also knew, did a similar study and came up with similar predictions. So they were already seeing that what you think you can become, what you're conditioned to believe about yourself, if you're conditioned to believe you have low value, you're never going to achieve anything, that you're a victim of your circumstances, then the likelihood is that in most people, not all, you would actually manifest that. So what you think does have a direct influence upon your whole being. And so those that I saw who were happy aging and not fearful, who didn't fear death because they had embraced life, who understood the meaning of their life and weren't running away from this empty, vacuous state that creates loneliness and depression because there's a lack of core meaningfulness in their life. In fact, I was just thinking this morning, I was writing an article, which I'll post next week on the website, and the article deals with life's meaningfulness is proportional to the level of our individual responsibilities on things that matter. And I don't want to go into that now, but I will go into it in the article, and you'll have a chance to read this. And that's directly proportional to what I saw in people who were getting old and didn't like it, but didn't do anything about it, and those who were getting older, but were happy with themselves. They understood who they were, their purpose in life, and they were always trying to grow that forward. If I know this today, what can I know more tomorrow? They were not staying in any form of intentional, intellectual, spiritual, or emotional neglect. And that's what this study is actually showing. Also, new research shows people with PAD could have an omega-3 deficiency. This is from the University of South Dakota, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Lipids. And it showed that people with this condition, PAD, and PAD stands for peripheral artery disease, very common in the United States because of our diet and smoking and drinking alcohol, you almost always have a lower omega-3 level in your body. So by having omega-3, you're able to protect your body from the diseases that affect your blood vessels outside the heart and the brain. And there are other studies that have shown this, that the more omega-3s you have to your body's essential needs, the less atherosclerosis you have, and the more endothelial functioning at a good level, meaning cleaning up, clearing out, and repairing the inner lining of your arteries and veins, promoting vasodilation through relaxation and smooth muscle cells. So, and omega-3s also have strong anti-inflammatory properties and anti-thrombotic actions, and it helps delay the plaques and increase their stability, decreasing wall stiffening. So all that can be helped if you take the omega-3 fatty acids. Also, from the Salk Institute, when neurons, those your brain cells, are out of shape, then antidepressants are not going to work like they would otherwise, according to this study. And I'm opposed to virtually all SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, because the science behind them is simply flawed to the max. And I've never seen a single person in my entire life cured from taking these, but I sure have with other non-toxic, non-pharmaceutical modalities. But they are the most commonly prescribed medication for major depression disorders. Yet scientists still do not understand why the treatment does not work in nearly 30% of patients with the mild depression. And the Salk Institute researchers have discovered differences in growth and patterns of neurons in patients. And this was published in Molecular Psychiatry. And so for those of us who believe in a natural way of keeping our brain and neurons healthy, we'll be looking at a whole series of interventions like anti-inflammatory, taking into the body that which turns off inflammation in the brain to begin with, and that protects your brain. Then to rebuild those neurons and those synaptic exchange points, and to unclutter, clean out the brain of dead debris, and reinvigorate your neurons, and reinvigorate your mitochondria. There are therapies that do that. I've discussed it many times. I even did a special. I've done a couple on for PBS stations. One was the food mood connection. The other was healing the brain naturally. So we can impact in a positive way almost every single brain condition. Harvard University has a study published in the Journal of Neurophysiology about sleep problems and Alzheimer's disease are linked. So the question is, which comes first? Alzheimer's leading to problems with sleep, or sleep problems leading to Alzheimer's? So they don't really know. But Alzheimer's research is largely focused on the presence of two proteins, and you've heard me mention many times in this program, the amyloid, A-M-Y-L-O-I-D, beta, B-E-T-A, and the tau, the T-A-U, in the brain. And amyloid beta is thought to be involved with learning and the ability of the brain to change and adapt. And the tau helps regulate normal signaling between neurons, which is between cell to cell. And people with Alzheimer's disease have been found to have both hallmarks, a buildup of amyloid plaque and tau tangles in the brain. And so this is just one more study showing that you really need to not have disruptions in your slow wave sleep or a deep sleep phase. And that causes amyloid beta levels to rise as much as 30%. So a good night's sleep is going to help prevent the amyloid from impacting your brain. And the presence of tau, the protein that is found tangled in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease, in the fluid that surrounds the brain and spinal cord, the cerebrospinal fluid, is a marker of injury to the nerve cells. So sleep deprivation for as little as one night has been found to increase the tau levels as by as much as 50% in cerebrospinal fluid. So how about this? How about not drinking any liquid 3 hours before you go to bed? Because when you drink liquid within an hour going to bed, you're going to wake up during the night because there's an automatic trigger mechanism that you start to feel discomfort because your bladder's full. So then you wake up, you go in, you turn on the light, and the moment that light goes on, that immediately tells the brain it's daytime, but it's not. But you're awake, and therefore it takes a lot longer to get back to sleep. So try to not drink so you don't wake up. That's very important. And finally, from St. Vincent's Medical Center in Connecticut, the role of vitamin D and its analogs in diabetic neuropathy. So according to the reporting, the diabetic neuropathy, and it is, it's true, it remains one of the most common causes of chronic kidney disease in the United States, and it's associated with significant morbidity and mortality. And recently, there's been emerging data highlighting the role of vitamin D and its analogs in chronic kidney disease, especially diabetic neuropathy, independent of its effect on bone metabolism. So make sure you're getting your vitamin D every single day. That's very important. And also, something from red sage extract exhibits antioxidant property against diabetic neuropathy also. And that was from the American Chinese Journal of Medicine. I'm Gary Nall, and that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and go directly into an audio-video clip of the G5 And they're advertising it everywhere now. But they're not saying G5. They're simply saying better, faster connections. Our network, and they're showing you diagrams and networking, and it's everywhere. And people are going, yeah, faster, faster. Well, not good, as you will see.
Is the stupidest idea in the history of the world, says a Washington professor. Sean Adelton to buy News Punch reports. Implementing 5G across the country is one of the most dangerous and stupidest ideas in the history of the world, a top biochemistry professor has warned. According to a recent report by Dr. Martin L. Paul, professor emeritus of biochemistry and basic medical sciences at Washington State University, 5G poses a massive health risk for EU, US, and international health. He states that, quote, putting in tens of millions of 5G antenna without a single biological test of safety has got to be about the stupidest idea anyone has had in the history of the world, end quote. I think most of us agree with his statement. Collective Evolution reports that report goes through a lot of science, which only adds to all of the science that's already available regarding the harmful effects of 5G technology. If you're looking for more information, I often point people towards the Environmental Health Trust because it's a great resource that gives you access to more science. This is not new information. For years, numerous studies have been published proving the health concerns regarding 5G technology, and hundreds of scientists have petitioned the United Nations about them. These initiatives started as a result of the work done by Dr. Martin Blank from Columbia University's Department of Psychology and Cellular Biophysics. According to him, with regards to wireless radiation in general, quote, we have created something that is harming us, and it is getting out of control. Before Edison's light bulb, there was very little electromagnetic radiation in our environment. The levels today are very many times higher than natural background levels, and are growing rapidly because of all the new devices that emit this radiation. Putting it bluntly, they are damaging the living cells in our bodies and killing many of us prematurely, end quote. Again, it's unbelievable that these technologies are being rolled out without any safety testing done. How is this even allowed to happen? The thing is, if there was safety testing done, there would likely be no changes made anyway, and these corporations would be allowed to roll out and utilize these technologies. Seeing how this article is about the work of Dr. Paul, below is the lecture that goes into detail about his research and why we should be concerned with 5G technologies, embedded in the video you'll have in the article. During the Health in Buildings Roundtable, it was sponsored by NIH and co-organized by the US CDC and several other organizations. Well, the CDC knows about this. The CDC should really make their statement really heard to the president, to the Congress, to the Senate, and to the United Nations. Now, Dr. Paul from Washington State University, WSU, concluded that the 5G rollout is absolutely insane. In this short presentation, Dr. Paul confirms that the current 2G, 3G, 4G radiation the population exposed to has been scientifically linked to lower fertility, insomnia, fatigue, depression, anxiety, major changes in the brain structure in animals, therefore humans as well, I would say, cellular DNA damage, oxidative stress, hormonal disruption, cancer, and much more. So you can imagine what 5G will do. Now, Dr. Paul briefly explained the mechanisms of how the electro-smog emitted by our cell phones, Wi-Fi routers, cell phone antennas, and other wireless technologies affect human cells. They've written about this topic in depth, and below are some recent articles we've published that go into more detail if you're looking for more information. On a side note, a lot of this information can spark a fearful reaction, and that's normal. It could elicit the same fearful reaction that you may have to other humanitarian issues, including the massive amounts of pesticides being sprayed in our environment and on our food, the rising deforestation rates.
Okay. Now we're going to go to what a young school kid said to a committee who was going to pass a resolution stating that if you weren't vaccinated, you couldn't get into school at all. And yet the science shows that it is not unvaccinated school children who are a threat to the children who have been vaccinated. Also, I've written an article completely debunking scientifically the concept, and it's just a concept, and it was a flawed concept of the herd mentality, because you've had more than 98% success in vaccinating communities. In spite of that, those communities still came down with all myriad of conditions from measles and mumps and chickenpox as examples. So this is this kid. Let's hear what he has to say.
Good afternoon. My name is Colin Aponte. I'm 14 years old from the town of Blue Hill and a freshman at John Baptist High School in Bangor. I'm the concertmaster of the Bangor Symphony Youth Orchestra and a state record holder on the Ellsworth YMCA swim team. I have performed violin at the Collins Center and Cross Center and will represent Maine this summer at Carnegie Hall in the National Youth Orchestra of the United States. Last year, I was the first student in Maine to win both the Maine State Spelling Bee and the Maine State Geography Bee. I was invited here to Augusta and honored with a legislative sentiment. I was featured on Maine television and in all the local newspapers. I went on to proudly represent the state of Maine in Washington, D.C., and had my picture taken with Senator Collins. Last year, I was celebrated here as an outstanding student. This year, I feel more like an outcast and a pariah. You see, I'm one of the unvaccinated kids you now consider a danger to public health and unworthy of the right to a public education in Maine. If LD 798 passes, I will no longer be allowed to attend Babst High School or any high school in Maine. I'll be kicked out of school, even though I'm not sick and have no disease. I'll be kicked out of school, even though I'm a high honors student with a 99.85 GPA. I'll be kicked out of school, even though I'm a leading member of the Babst Chamber Orchestra and swim team. I'll be kicked out of school, even though I add much needed racial diversity to the classroom as a Hispanic. I'll be kicked out of school, even though teens who vape, take drugs, get drunk, and bully are often allowed to remain. I will be punished, shamed, and stigmatized because my parents dare to exercise their religious freedom to choose what I inject into my body. Given the devastating impact LD 798 will have on me, I have four questions for you. One, why are you unfairly singling out unvaccinated kids? You must know that vaccinated kids carry and spread disease too. Will you kick them out of school if their immunity wanes or a blood titer shows they never developed immunity in the first place? Two, why are you unfairly singling out kids? Why aren't you requiring every single adult in Maine to follow the CDC vaccine schedule in order to protect public health? Three, what will happen to me? As an unvaccinated kid, will I be allowed out in public or quarantined at home? Will I be forced to wear a badge on my clothing or a tattoo on my arm to warn people to stay away from me? And four, why can't the law remain as it is now? Right now, if someone contracts a disease at school, unvaccinated kids have to stay home until the threat passes. This seems like the perfect compromise. It allows me the right to a public education and keeps the spread of disease to a minimum. But LD 798 goes way too far. Under LD 798, I will have no educational future in Maine. Please do not pass this bill. Thank you for your time and attention.
Well said. Keep this in mind, that the vast majority of people, mainly couples right now, who are choosing not to have the vaccine schedule as it is mandated are only coming to that place after they had vaccine-injured children or themselves vaccine-injured. They did their homework and found that the scientific peer-reviewed literature on the Library of Medicine does not support a single vaccine as being safe, not one, ever, in history. Not only that, it was upheld by the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court that vaccines are inherently unsafe. Then I reviewed over 1,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on toxicology, something that is never, I mean never, brought up in any discussion of vaccines. And every single toxicologist we interviewed said that the ingredients in the vaccine make the vaccine itself toxic, that there are no safe levels of a toxin such as mercury or the adjuvant aluminum or formaldehyde. And then the studies showing that vaccines work are themselves grossly flawed. An example, if you give 1,000 people the flu vaccine and 90% of them don't come down with the flu, the CDC will then turn around and through mathematical alchemy say that the flu vaccine was 90% effective this year, giving no credit to individual lifestyles, healthy dietary and emotional choices, de-stressing, all the things that can cause a person not to get the flu in the first place. So the science is not accurate. We've invited pro-vaccine people on the show. They have refused to come. I wish they would. I've spent 15,000 hours of methodical research. I've published over 52 articles, all from peer-reviewed journal literature, the references. So I'm using their science to show that they don't have science on their side. And yet there's a massive campaign worldwide. In Italy, you can't go to school if you're not vaccinated. In Australia, it is so bad that if you talk against vaccines, you could end up in prison for 10 years. And now there is a shaming going on in the United States of attacking any physician, nurse, or parent. And think of it this way. Think of the trauma, the horror, the sadness of having a child that's been diagnosed with a serious adverse vaccine reaction, some requiring them to be maintained for life with no insurance. And now they have to bear that. Now they're being attacked by the Bill Gates people through his funding of the pro-vaccine initiative and other pro-vaccine pharmaceutical companies and their bots and their provocateurs. And the world is not outraged by this. So it's a double negative against the vaccine victim. That is how sick we have become in this vaccine issue. I will continue to write articles about vaccines. I will continue to produce specials on vaccines because this is only getting worse, and these people have a great deal of influence and in our legislative process. And I know where they're going. I can tell you exactly where they're going. They're going to make vaccines mandatory at the state level for children and then go to mandatory adult vaccines. And they've got 400 vaccines approximately in the pipeline. And they're going to try to get as many of those vaccines into your child's body as possible. And they're indemnified, so no matter what happens, if your child's damaged or dies, they don't care. They've made their profit. And that's the entire game that they have afoot. Now let's hear from a person that chose not to self-censor, nor be censored. He had a few choice words, only in a minute and 44 seconds, but I think we need to hear it again.
The police are able to use the press to make the white public think that 90% or 99% of the Negroes in the Negro community are criminals. And once the white public is convinced that most of the Negro community is a criminal element, then this automatically paves the way for the police to move into the Negro community, exercising Gestapo tactics, stopping any black man who is on the sidewalk, whether he is guilty or whether he is innocent, whether he is well-dressed or whether he is poorly dressed, whether he is educated or whether he is dumb, whether he's a Christian or whether he's a Muslim. As long as he is black and a member of the Negro community, the white public thinks that the white policeman is justified in going in there and trampling on that man's civil rights and on that man's human rights. They can go in and question, brutalize, murder unarmed, innocent Negroes, and the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals.
For the younger people in our audience, that's Malcolm X. And it's worth listening to some of what he has to say. You can agree or disagree, but a lot of the things he was saying there in the 1950s and 60s are absolutely relevant today. Now I'm going to end our audio discussion with an understanding of children that's a little different than what the helicopter parents, those are people that spoil their children. Generally, these are professionals, business, lawyers, doctors, engineers. And even though the parent may have worked very hard and very dedicated and disciplined in their career to get successful, what they have done more often than not is to show that their children should have the privilege of their wealth and success without having to do it on their own. And as a result, they have lived in an environment that is very similar to a bubble, where they live, the people they socialize with, the schools they go to, as we've seen recently, wanting to go to the elite school, even though all the studies I've read, and I'm doing a show on it next week, show that going to Harvard or going to a state university, the outcome ultimately is about the same. So we've been living with the myth that you get better education and better qualified teachers. You don't. Again, these are the myths we live by, and we codify them in our own ignorance. So now you have a new parent. So the spoiled children, remember, they didn't choose to be spoiled. It's like an adapted taste. You know, you taste something often enough, then you can adapt to it. These were children who were convinced that they are the new elite trust babies, except instead of coming from very wealthy aristocracy or in olden times, the robber barons, the Astors and the Vanderbilts. No, they're the mothers and fathers work 80 hours a week to give them everything. But they didn't give them discipline. They didn't give them conscience or character. They didn't give them morality or manners. They didn't give them attention to social or political, economic or civil or cultural issues. They didn't give them a depth of the history of our country and other cultures and where we got to where we at, the best and worst of us. They didn't give them any background into our exceptionalism on the good side and the exceptionalism on the downside. They're absolutely vacuous intellectually. And therefore, they're confused. And they're self-absorbed. Now you've got a whole new type of parent. And this is called the bulldozer parent. If you haven't heard that term, what it means is the parents, through sheer determination, want to plow, like a bulldozer, every obstacle that you're going to have as a kid so that they've done all of the work for you so you don't have to have any problems in life. They've all been solved for you until you get into the real world, until you meet people that are not going to be under your control or your parents' control, and wow. Now you're completely, totally unprepared for the world you live in. That's the bulldozer parent. Here is Jordan Peterson giving us his thoughts on this. And on some things I fully agree with, and some things I am completely of the opposite opinion. But I don't disqualify someone on one level because I may have a difference with them politically if what they're saying has meaning. And I believe this has some meaning. It's a short clip, only 3 minutes long.
When you love someone, you love them not only despite their fragility, but also because of it. They wouldn't be who they were if they weren't fragile and limited in their particular way. When you have a sick kid, it's like, oh my God, how can the world be constituted so that a child can unfairly suffer in this manner? You can't have them being vulnerable and cute and interesting and small and needing care but striving to develop and grow without them also being prone to pain and destruction and vulnerability. Yeah. Yeah. And then what do? You teach them to be strong. That's what you do. You don't get rid of the vulnerability. You teach them to be strong. You don't protect your children. In fact, you do the opposite. You expose them to the world as much as you possibly can, and you make them strong. That's the best antidote to their vulnerability. The first noble truth of Buddhism, life is suffering. This is true, and it's worse than that because it's suffering contaminated by malevolence. And so that's very pessimistic. But the optimistic part is that you are so damn tough, you can actually not only deal with that, you can improve it. It's like, oh, well, that's a horrible situation. But it turns out that I'm armed for the task. Well, that's a great thing for people to know. I think the fact that we're armed for the task is even more true than the fact that life is catastrophe contaminated by malevolence. We're stronger than things are terrible. And I do believe it's the case because I've watched people do very difficult things, like people who work in palliative care wards. So all they're ever dealing with is pain and death, right? And they can do it. They get up in the morning, they go to work, and they take care of those people. They lose people on a weekly basis, and yet they can do it. And what that shows is that if you turn around and you confront the suffering voluntarily, you find out that you are way tougher than you think. It's not that life is better than you think. Life is as harsh as you think. It might even be worse, but you are way tougher than you think if you turn around and confront it. It's a very good thing to know, and it's not naive optimism. Yeah. It's a very different thing. It's like, no, things are terrible. They're brutal, and you are so damn tough, you can't believe it.
I believe that makes a great deal of sense, at least from my perspective. I believe that my generation, the baby boomers, of which you many of you are also baby boomers, we had the benefit, we had the blessing of insight from a generation that suffered. There was no safety nets for them for most of that suffering. The Great Depression and Second World War put together that 16 years out of their life. And what if you entered that cycle of deprivation at a very young age? They were stronger because of it. Many succumbed, but those who didn't learned the lessons. And that's why my parents said, we're not going to go buy you a new pair of jeans. You're going to wear your brother's jeans, and then Steve will wear your jeans. That's how we grew up. Three of us sleeping in the same bed. Three of us in a full-size bed. That wasn't the best thing that I can remember growing up. But we understood it. And today, everybody wants to make sure that no one in their family has anything that would cause a triggered sensation or any form of trauma. But then we need to know about life. When I post a video, for example, or a photograph of an animal, an innocent sentient animal being slaughtered or tortured or abused, it's not to offend the audience. It's to make them aware that if they are still eating meat, that's a part of their problem. They've created that. Only when we become aware of, oh my goodness, you mean my intentional neglect of knowing what it is that I'm doing and where things come from, the progenitor of all things, I'm causing the suffering of that creature. So it's not an existential abstract on a page. It's real. So therefore it may cause you to rethink eating meat. One of the things I found with children who used to come up in the 1970s at the Fertiller Farm was that there were all these rescued animals, and they were all loving. And the children just spent all day. They didn't want to go home at night because they were loving all these animals, getting hugs and kisses. And that's all they didn't care about eating. They just wanted to be with the animals. Now, I asked those kids the next day, do you want to have chicken? What do you mean chicken? You know, like the chicken you normally have and the chicken that you were loving? No. I don't want to do that. So we have to face the reality of life if we're ever to come up on the positive side of it. That said, we have to take an honest look at the world we live in right now. We should be pro-positive choices in all the decisions we make. what it goes into my body, that's my choice. I want it to be positive. Therefore, I want a healthy outcome. If I vote for someone, I want to vote for someone who is not there based upon their ego or special donor groups and lobbyists putting them in places. I want to vote for someone that I know has everyone's interest at stake, rich and poor, the environment and animals. But we don't live in that world right now. We live, unfortunately, according to Professor Giroux, we live in a post-truth world. And that's unfortunate. We live in a pre-truth world for those of us who are looking at everything where the truth has yet to arrive. Well, when's it going to catch up? We're told something, and based upon our allegiance, we're exposed to believe it because someone on CNN or someone on Fox or someone on MSNBC or someone at Mother Jones says it. That does not make it true. If anything, today, it requires an additional element of doing my own personal homework to see, have I been told the truth that empowers me, or have I been manipulated by propaganda that disempowers me? And as one of the primary currencies of politics, lies have a long history in the United States. For instance, state-sponsored lies played a crucial ideological role in pushing the U.S. into wars in Vietnam, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Libya. It legitimated the use of torture under the Bush administration and covered up the crimes of the financial elite in producing the economic crisis of 2008. And under Trump, lying has become a rhetorical gimmick in which everything that matters politically is denied, reason loses its power for informed judgments, and language serves it to depoliticize, meaning you're taking a position that is supposed to disarm people who would have a contrary point of view, as it offers no room for individuals to translate private troubles into broader systemic considerations. For example, when we talk about asset forfeiture, there's no dialogue on it because those in power, the judicial system and the police, believe that they have a right, even though it's against the law, to take innocent people's assets with no consequence, and they've taken billions of dollars of their assets. That should be a major point of view. What happened to our individual freedoms? My body should be mine to decide what goes in it. Now, if you're going to say, no, your body belongs to the CDC, and if you do not vaccinate, you're deprived of a job in a hospital or a school to attend, but then you don't turn around and say, at the same time, you cannot drink unfluoridated water. You cannot eat any healthy food. You must eat hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries every day, every meal. You cannot watch culturally inspired television. You must watch dumbed down, canned laughter television. It can't do that. There would be an uprising immediately. But selectively they do it. And we say, well, it's not important to me. We stay intentionally ignorant. It certainly appears to matter in democracy, particularly when it became imperative to be able to distinguish, however difficult, between facts and fiction, reliable knowledge and falsehoods, and good and evil. That, however, no longer appears to be the case. In the current historical moment, the boundaries between truth and fiction are disappearing, giving way to a culture of lies, immediacy, consumerism, falsehoods, debt accumulation, demonization of those considered disposable, or those who challenge. So if I challenge or you challenge the legitimacy of GMO foods and the illegitimacy of, let's say, the vaccine movement, we are considered disposable. And under such circumstances, civic culture withers and politics collapses into the personal. At the same time, pleasure is harnessed to a culture of corruption and cruelty and language that operates in the service of violence, and the boundaries of the unthinkable become normalized. I mean, what if every day when you woke up in the morning, instead of going to your computer and turning it on and seeing what news there is, what if all of the all of the bombing and drone strikes around the world that we instigated, the Trump administration, and before that the Obama administration, and before that the Bush administration, what if we saw on the ground the firsthand experience of what it is for someone to be blown up? And then the first responders are, it's called a double tap. First, you kill the people that you were intending to kill. No matter how many innocents are killed, this is considered collateral damage, completely indifferent. And then you kill the responders who come to pick those up. In case there's anyone that you wanted to kill who came to pick up the body parts, you kill them as well. What if we had to get that in before breakfast? That was our reality check for the day. Ah, then that violence and the boundaries of the unthinkable become normalized, and we begin to either accept that. Okay, I want my morning infusion of horror, trauma, crisis. Or we say, this is repulsive. How can we call ourselves a civilized society and have this? How can you look at China that has one of the most important architectural achievements in history, currently now, with the greatest emphasis upon solar and renewable resources, and at the same time, that same highly advanced technological societies boiling dogs alive, having a million Muslims in detainment camps, shooting people who are dissidents and controlling all media, censoring thousands of sites. And we're supposed to believe that it all is okay, and it's not. It's not. And how else to explain President Trump's strategy of separating babies and young children from their undocumented immigrant parents in order to incarcerate in Texas in what some, in what is clearly an inhumane circumstance? Now, that's part of a larger argument, but the mere fact that we're still doing that and have been doing it through multiple presidencies shows that we are no closer to understanding solutions, and we're misleading in rhetoric so as not to take personal responsibility. So we are indifferent to the boundaries between truth and falsehoods, and that reflects not only a deep-seated anti-intellectualism, but also it's our collective willingness to judge and appeal to the truth as inseparable from an unquestioned individual and group loyalty on the part of all those who follow that. I mean, let us stop being the self-defined soul bearers of truth, because everyone believes they're a bearer of truth. And then being disdainful of reason, judgment, and evidence. I, for example, yesterday on our sister station, WBAI, I presented a one-hour documentary with individuals, medical doctors, board-certified people who were first-hand witnesses to a holistic protocol program that reversed HIV into HIV negative and AIDS-defining illnesses into total health. Not once or twice, but many, many times. And yet, you would never know that if you didn't actually see that with your own eyes. And yet still, even showing that to people, they will still live in denial of that. And yet that's a truth that they don't have any counterpoint to. And I was not there to attack their system of treating with toxic drugs, people with AZT. In fact, one clip showed that, where I said, if you want to use AZT, you should have a right to do it, but we shouldn't be limited in our right to help people with other therapies that actually, in an immunosuppressed person, don't give them immunosuppressive drugs. It's a compounding negative. We want to give an immune-suppressed person with HIV infection, we want to give them immune-stimulating therapies, and that's what was done. And yet that was such a threat to the multi-billion dollar AIDS industry. And many of those people were so connected to keeping that cash cow coming that they lied, no matter what the evidence. And that's what we have in all areas of life today. No matter what the evidence, no matter what the facts, no matter what the truth, there are always going to be those who are engaged in an epidemic of dishonesty at every level. And truth is now part of a web of or relations and worldview that draws its elements from a fascist politics and fascist consumerism. Now, fascist consumerism is probably a term you've never heard of because I just made it up. And it involves where business is willing to subvert and subjugate your rights of what to do with your life and your purchases because they want to command the total commodification of all things that you engage in, whether you need it or not, whether it's good for you or not, whether it destroys the environment and our resources is irrelevant. They want to control your life. And hence, that only contributes to this epidemic of dishonesty. And they command the political institutions. They own the media landscape. So truth is no longer merely fragile or problematic. Truth today simply does not exist. It is anathema. It does not harmonize with toxic and dysfunctional media ecosystems and echo chambers controlled by both the left and the right. And hence we are the victims because we have yet to differentiate what is in our own best interest, what is the country's best interest, and what is the world's best interest. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.